Dr. Simeon Heim worked as an assistant professor at Washington State University in statistics and sociology. He became interested in remote viewing in 1996. After studying various targets, including crop circles, he began investigating the crop circle phenomenon. He's authored four books dealing with crop circles, remote viewing, cryptoids, UFOs, and various experiences, and he's here today on Exopolitics Today.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
Well, welcome, Simeon, Dr. Hine, to Exopolitics Today.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me here today.
Well, we've known each other for quite a few years, and I think we've met at various conferences, and I know that you worked as an academic before you became interested in this really very strange world of UFOs, remote viewing, crop circles, and so forth. So why don't you first give people an idea of your academic background before telling us about how you got interested in the remote viewing topic?
Right. I got a PhD in sociology. My interest was in technology. I was actually interested in how we're affected by information technology. This was in late 80s, early 90s, as we started to see information technology evolve. And since I was a little kid, I was always interested in machines. I used to like to build things, electronic kits. But at a deeper level, I was always wondering how we're all affected by this acceleration of information and energy through modern technology, primarily since World War II. It seems to have changed very quickly. And I was always curious why that was so and how it was affecting our sense of reality. So I did this dissertation about how to look at the types of information we're around. Do we comprehend as much information overload? And I have to say, I think I was kind of right. I sort of predicted we suffer from information overload as you had more and more instantaneous types of information compared to, 150 years ago, where it took mail 2 weeks to get across the US on the Pony Express in the 1850s. And now we can send, emails with our smartwatches and texts. So I feel like a lot of the sort of predictions I made have actually panned out, which is that people's sense of reality has become somewhat fragmented. And there's a kind of a destabilization of society. But the positive side of that is it's allowing us to talk about topics through venues like this with this type of technology, to talk about things that I think people in the past were discouraged from talking about. And just as an example in my own life, when I was about 12 or 13, my mom took me to the Everglades with her. She was a bird watcher. And we were in the Everglades with our binoculars, and a very big, bright object was hovering right over us that at the time I thought was the moon. And I said to my mom, look at this strange green moon. And she was looking over there because that's where the moon was. She said, be quiet, kid. I'm looking at some big heron through my binocs. And then she finally looked up at it and we both pointed our binoculars and it was sort of amorphous and structured at the same time. And my little teenage mind at the time, pre-teenage mind, I could not make sense of what I was looking at. It was like a perfectly round cloud, but there were structured dots in it, which we could see with the binoculars. And it went from being completely stationary to quickly moving into a cloud as soon as we started looking at it. And I can still remember the feeling of that object. It just felt to me like it was non-earthly, like it didn't belong. Like it was like nothing I'd ever seen before. We went to the ranger talk that night. The ranger said, does anyone want to share anything interesting they saw today? So my mom, being the intrepid soul that she was, raised her hand, said, we saw a UFO. And there was a blackout, by the way, right at that moment. And the ranger said, oh, that's interesting. Did anyone else see anything today? Like she brushed it over. So even in those early years, I could see my mom said, we saw a UFO. So that's sort of where my interest in the topic probably started. Even though, Michael, I didn't really follow up much apart from reading a few books. John Keel's book, Mothman Prophecies, was something I remember reading as a teenager. And later coming across, I believe, at the University of Arizona bookstore, Above Top Secret by Timothy Good. And so it was sort of there in the background, but nobody ever talked about this anywhere from kindergarten to PhD. I never heard anyone mention any of these topics. So for me, perhaps these were subjects way back in, you know, the depths of my curiosity that I hadn't talked about much, but it was there. So when I came across this again through remote viewing, perhaps it just woke something up that had been there since, you know, that sighting in the Everglades.
So you're working as an assistant professor at Washington State University, the place where you got your PhD.
Yeah.
And then at some point you learn about remote viewing as a discipline, that you hear about it in an interview on radio, and right, you're skeptical. So, you know, how did you make the transition from being skeptical to like actually doing a course?
It's a good question, Michael. What I ended up studying in the Department of Sociology at WC was something called fractal geometry. We've all heard of fractals now, and a guy named Benoit Mandelbrot sort of popularized them. I believe it was in the 80s. He was working for IBM studying signal line noise, and he realized that there are many phenomena in nature that are not linear, that they're characterized by these fractured type of patterns that keep branching, like our cardiovascular system, or tree branches, or even mountain ranges and clouds. The closer you look, the more detail you see. Fractal geometry is how nature actually works, and we're the ones that impose a sort of linear Euclidean structure on it. And fractals lead you to chaos theory, because chaotic systems describe fractal-like patterns. And so I came across another graduate student that sort of piqued an interest in my mind about the applications of chaos theory and fractal geometry as perhaps ways, you know, and younger graduate students are always looking for new avenues, new ways of approaching topics, because people always want to do something that's a little different than people have done before. I started getting interested in what sort of systems would be described by chaos theory and fractals rather than lines. And why? Because in statistics, everything is based on these linear approximations. I mean, this is drilled into my head from course after course in statistics and research methods, is you have these linear regression lines. We're all familiar with this idea of sort of linear relationships. And what chaos theory says is that a butterfly flapping its wings over the Amazon forest can affect the weather in China, the butterfly effect. And there was a whole movie about this called Jurassic Park by Michael Crichton, right? Where a tiny little change in the dinosaurs, sort of this idea that you can't really control nature in the end. It's always going to find a way around your cages. So that was sort of my approach to research methods, was to look at chaos theory as a way to study real world systems and kind of get beyond the limitations of linear regression, which is based on what averages and standard deviations. Now, when I came across remote viewing, I heard Courtney Brown, who you've had on the show before, I believe, just not too long ago. And he was talking about this declassified government program that had trained the average person to have psychic functioning for specific applications within military and intelligence communities. And it happened to be that his specialty was also chaos theory. So there was sort of a connection there. Now, having studied these topics of fractal geometry, I got a lot of resistance within the department at the time from the older professors about whether this had any value. And so I could immediately see there were probably topics that people had not looked at from a different angle for decades, because they were so attached to this sort of traditional statistics, which has come under a lot of fire recently for how, you know, the whole idea of averages and the average person and so forth, the idea of normalcy, as using that as your baseline measurement. I mean, ever since COVID, we've realized that even something that starts out really small could become really big pretty quickly. Ordinary statistics can't really handle that very well. So I think to answer your question, I was prepared, having seen a UFO with my mom perhaps as a teenager, but not really professionally or even privately talked about it very much in the intervening years. But I was open to the idea that there could be topics that science had missed. I could see it within my own discipline of sociology that there was a linear bias. And I knew that just from taking statistics courses in other departments at WSU, that there were other statistical distributions, but I never heard those mentioned in my stats courses in social sciences. It was just pretty much a linear, you know, mindset. And we know that there are nonlinear processes too, and things that start out small can have big effects. So I was open to the idea that there were probably phenomena that didn't fit into a linear mindset. And I thought perhaps RV, even though I wasn't really a believer at the time that the average person had any special psychic ability, I was open to the idea there could be things that were real that I hadn't been told about in 27 years from kindergarten to PhD. It just opened my mind is if fractals are real and chaos theory and you know, there's sort of resistance to even that idea, what else could be out there that we should be looking at? And so I was open to the idea that this could be it. And when I took the course at Farsight Institute, I found that the results exceeded my expectations.
Okay, so this was sometime in 1996. You do your first course in the Farsight, at the Farsight Institute, organized by Dr. Courtney Brown. And so then after you begin doing various remote viewing of different targets. So you want to tell us about some of the targets? You sent me some pictures, and let's begin with the Tower of Pisa.
Before we get to that, let me just explain that when you do RV, you could view anything, Michael, because the viewer is not given any information ahead of time, for the most part. It's going to be either single or double blind, which means that either the viewer will be blind to the target initially, it'll be put in a folder, and nowadays just in your computer somewhere in a file. And the viewer won't be told what it is till the end of the session. And maybe the monitor might be blind to the target too for a more kind of controlled experiment. And so you start out with verifiable targets and then you sort of progress sometimes later on to non-verifiable targets. Why do you start with verifiable targets? You just want to see that you can kind of get anything at all, right? So you do things like, you know, Eiffel Tower or Mount Kilimanjaro, Washington Monument, you know, just verifiable targets. Everyone knows what they are to see how you're doing when you use these protocols, which, you know, were developed by CIA, DIA, through Stanford Research Institute, as it was called by the time, at the time in the early 70s. And someone that most people are familiar with now, Ingo Swann, who passed away in 2013, created these protocols. And that was the system I learned. It's called CRV, Coordinate Remote Viewing, or some people call it Controlled Remote Viewing. And so I was an instructor at Farsight and later the head instructor. And when I left Farsight in early 97, I was kind of going to let it go. And I had this very strong dream one night where I was given kind of an instruction in this very lucid dream to continue teaching. And it was so convincing to me, I set up my own institute here in Boulder, Colorado. And what these sessions that we're about to look at are the results of classes that we've had here and I've taught in other places. So go ahead and you can put the first slide up again that you're about to show just to explain where this is. So this is a kind of example of a verifiable target. Lean Tower. So this is why this is sort of an interesting RV target. You can, when we do RV, we like go through travel magazines or something or any type of magazine, cut out pictures, interesting looking pictures, and put them in a folder. And then we write these coordinates on the folder. All the viewer gets are these random numbers. I mean, for a while it was the longitude and latitude, and there was a criticism, maybe you had these people with this eidetic memory who had memorized the map. This was a criticism at SRI back then. And so we just use random numbers. Now, here's what's interesting about this target. We could see the Tower of Pisa head on, right, with the Leaning Tower and the buildings behind it. But if you look what the viewer drew here, it's from the side, right? When I saw this drawing, I couldn't tell if it was accurate in terms of those hills or mountains behind the complex. If you can just show the original picture again, it's head on, right? But the viewer draws it from the side. When I did more investigation, as anyone who's ever been there knows, but I hadn't been there, I looked at pictures of it. Those hills are behind it at that correct angle too, looking from, I believe, from the west. So what this shows us, Michael, is that the viewer is not just like viewing their feedback picture. They're actually at the site in some way, or they're getting information from the whole site, more than we can see in the picture, and even more than the monitor can see, right? Isn't that interesting? Because those hills are right there, if you look at any picture online of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. So not only, without any cue whatsoever, did they reproduce a leaning tower, as you can clearly see in their drawing, right? And the complex of buildings behind the tower. And it's even leaning at the correct angle, pretty much. They also identified aspects of the target that I couldn't see as the monitor or anyone in the class at the time. It's a blind target. So it shows us they're really getting information from the location in some way, which has, you know, been shown over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Do you roll on the one?
Okay. So that's an example of a verifiable target. And now you sent me another one, and it looks like something that involves a facility. I mean, there's a complex.
Right. Okay. So this is a fascinating target. So someone who had allegedly worked in the government sent me this picture and said, you know, we'd like to test you. I would like to test you. I'm retired now, but I'd like to find out if RV works, if you guys are in good. So she sent us this photo of Groom Lake, of the hangars at Groom Lake in Area 51. And you can see those MIGs that they test, you know, they test foreign planes so they can figure out how they work. And I had sent this to a viewer in Salt Lake City, and the phone call was really short. I called this person, Terry, and I simply said, Terry, you know, I have this target for you. Would you like to do it? And she said, yes. And I read her the target coordinates, and we hung up the phone. And about 2 hours later, out of my fax machine, you'll see the drawing that she did. You can even see the little holes from the paper. It was three-punch paper. Out of my fax machine pops a pretty close replica of the picture. You can see the hangars, the doors, right? Big black open spaces, the planes in front and everything. And I mean, if anyone has any doubts that this can work, I literally said nothing to her beyond, would you like to do a target? Here are the coordinates. End of phone call. She's 500 miles away from me, from Boulder to Salt Lake, and yet she's able to literally reproduce those hangar doors with no monitoring, no cues, no interaction with me whatsoever. And, you know, it was the type of experience, Michael, where you start looking around wondering if there are cameras in your room. And I remember, you know, people at the CIA talking that way when they saw early sessions done by people like Ingo Swann and others, when it was just picture perfect accurate. And this was one of those sessions. Again, what this shows us is that ordinary people just with some training can do work as good as the best natural psychics.
In that case, I mean, her accuracy, I mean, this is Groom Lake, so it's a classified facility.
Yeah.
And she brought back some what seemed to be very accurate data. Now, you just mentioned that she wasn't particularly special in any way, but what was it? I mean, what is it that can produce a high degree of accuracy versus remote viewing, which is somehow, you know, more inaccurate, subjective. I mean, what is it that, you know, what distinguishes excellent remote viewing from something that is kind of like compromised?
It's a really good question. I mean, it's something we think about all the time, those of us who are involved with this. And I once asked this to Ingo Swann at one of the IRVA conventions in the Vegas area. It was in North Vegas at that particular year. And he answered to me that he thought, well, he answered to the whole audience, that people that are more in touch with their right brain, the more holistic, contextual part of our brain that doesn't think in words as much as in images, musicians, artists, people like that, were better remote viewers. And Terry was always a very accurate remote viewer from the beginning. She's still an accurate remote viewer. She worked with, took classes from Lynn Buchanan like I did. She follows the protocol. I think she's also very sensitive and she feels like she had some ET contact as a very young child outside of her school when she would walk to school in the morning. In fact, I put one of her stories in my Black Swan ghost books where she felt like she was taken to a special school every morning. Even she told me that, since you're asking why she's can do sessions like that, she the teacher once called her mom and said Terry had been missing from school for 2 weeks, and Terry thought she had been going to a school. It was just with these short beings that were in the bushes that would have her come somewhere else and they would teach her things. And she, as a young little kid, thought, oh, I'm going to school. I'm learning about math and science. So perhaps she had some contact as a youngster that perhaps many of us have had this and forgotten. So there could be another influence. I'm just speculating here, obviously, of course. But some people like Terry do very accurate work. And some people occasionally do very accurate work, and some of it's just less accurate the rest of the time. But everyone is capable of really accurate sessions from time to time. And for some reason, some people seem to have more consistency with their session.
Well, that's very interesting what you mentioned about Terry, because I've come across that quite a few times, that people who have been involved with an alien contact, whether it's the, you know, the more positive contact with the kind of human-looking ETs, or whether it's the contact or the abductions with the short greys, reptilians or whatever, that at the end of the day, those people are more psychic, that they have abilities. So it sounds like Terry is one of those people. And I know, you know, I first came across this George Hunt Williamson. He back, I think, he was one of the people that worked with George Adamski in the 1950s. And he came across this young contactee or abductee, Michael Cravant Wolf. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. But he had contact, and immediately after the contact, it was like he just became precocious. He had these psychic abilities. So, yeah, I mean, that to me raises that very interesting question. Are the best remote viewers typically ones that have had some kind of alien contact?
It's a very good question, and I don't think we have the answer yet, because this is not a topic yet that has been studied in any great detail. It's certainly not something that academics are studying or the types of institutions that could do a large-scale study like this. You would imagine, Michael, you'd have to survey a lot of people, identify people who felt they had this type of contact as a kid. I don't remember personally having any contact like that as a kid, but I've met many people who do remember that type of contact. And then we would have to do these sort of testing of them with RV procedures and see, do they score higher in terms of accuracy? There'll be kind of a long in-depth project, but I could see someone doing that, you know, in a proper institution. These things could take years to do it properly. So to answer that type of question, our society needs to get to the point where they're willing to engage these questions. And I think, as you and I know, as of the recording of this show today in February 2024, we're not quite there yet, but we're sort of inching in that direction, right? So perhaps all these congressional hearings will lead to some institutes and organizations being developed or funded to look into these questions seriously. And do, I mean, sociologists like me, we do survey research. We create questionnaires. We ask people these questions. You put it all together and then you correlate their answers with other, you know, other aspects of them in some ways. And this is a great topic to look into, but it has, society has to decide that they're willing to fund this and that the institutions that do this type of research have to switch. I mean, I come out of research method, so it's a great question. And it's something that I wonder about too.
Yeah. So, I mean, you did that remote viewing of Groom Lake Area 51 and Terry helped you with that one, or she was the RV for that one. Have you done remote viewing of other kind of like sensitive or classified facilities?
Yes.
Is that something you can share?
I think so. It's not something we do, you know, as a main priority. It's not like we're interested in like snooping around places. But honestly, RV gives you the ability to look anywhere and even into the future. The past, and you can, as you can see from the two sessions you've just shown, you can get this very accurate information of, and it's veridical, as we've been saying, verifying. We can't do that with every single target, but I remember Dr. Roger Lear, who did all of those analyses of implants.
Yes.
The podiatrist from California passed away a number of years ago. I remember talking to him at the citizen hearing for disclosure in DC. He was one of the witnesses and we had a nice conversation there. And that was the last time I talked to him, but I talked to him many times. And he once asked me, he said, you know, Simeon, I live in this place called the Simi Valley in California. And there's like this facility nearby. And we all wonder, is it a, you know, the Rocketdyne facility? Is it like a real deep underground base or what's going on there? So I actually gave this to one of the best viewers I've known, a woman who had been in the Olympics as a marathon runner, held some world records and so forth. And she came back, no advanced information about the target, just coordinates. I gave her the coordinates and she came back with this very complex base. And we used these sliding exercises to go down, up and down in levels. And she saw a lot of activity, and her final sentence was, this whole underground facility seems to be connected to a nearby city, which would be, you know, LA or something like that. So I went back to Roger Lear about a couple months later, the next time I saw him at a conference, and I said, oh, here's your session, Roger. Looks like you got a real base underground facility, you know, real black budget facility there. But you can actually go far beyond that. We've done many UFO targets over the years, you know, Phoenix Lights, you know, sightings where there are many many witnesses. Not just a video that someone took, but where you had a lot of people say they saw something, and we've given those targets to people repeatedly. And it's just interesting that you get these consistent sort of results from those. They'll get a craft, they'll get something anomalous about it, alternative type of propulsion. They'll walk around, even occasionally feel like they're meeting inhabitants of this craft inside. And the strange thing about it, Michael, is that they often report that they feel like they're being viewed back while the session is happening. I mean, you rarely ever get people saying that in a conventional target.
That's interesting. But
yes, it is interesting. And who are we to judge what they're saying? This is what they say they're perceiving. I haven't given them any information ahead of time about the target. This is not front-loaded session. And they say, look, I feel like these beings are viewing me back. And occasionally, they even feel like they're being told to leave. So,
I remember in Ingo Swann's book, Penetration, there's a famous incident where he was tasked to do a remote viewing session and he finds himself on the far side of the moon. He sees these extraterrestrials walking around and he says that one notices him and his handler at the time it was an Axelrod telling, I mean, he's telling Axelrod what he's seeing. And then he said, oh, the being is looking at me. And Axelrod said, get out of there really quick. So, I mean, well, what are the dangers of remote viewers looking at extraterrestrial activities?
I don't think there are any dangers to it, as far as I can see. And the reason being is that I don't actually think you're there at the site. I think you're tuning into a common frequency and the information is coming to you. And it could be like a two-way radio where you're communicating. But I think the viewer is always in charge. It's like being in a movie theater. It can feel very real. You can feel like you're there. You could feel the emotions. You could describe it very accurately, as you would be able to watching a movie in a big screen. It's like that more than like a sort of astral projection, in my view, more like tuning into a radio signal. So I haven't seen any effects more than you would expect from a scary movie or something like that. And you can always walk out of the theater, right? Mm-hmm. You are having a real experience and you are experiencing real feelings, but they're coming from you. You're perceiving something akin to a screen. It doesn't mean that the screen itself doesn't have its own viewers and there isn't something like a CB radio going on, or ham radio. I mean, there could be some sort of communication, but you can break it off, in my experience, just from what we've done over the years at the Mount Baldwin Institute.
Okay. Now, I did an interview with John Vivanco, who kind of started off around the same time, 96, 97. He began remote viewing and did something similar, set up his own remote viewing organization. He says that he was working with a female who was so accurate that at some point she and he were starting to get harassed by the intelligence community because they were kind of like doing some remote viewing for different clients, and their results, I guess, were so significant that they were being warned off. So has anything like that ever happened to you?
No. No, I have never, we've never done a target or had anyone contact us and say you shouldn't be doing that. And of course, I've mainly been motivated just by teaching people that they have this ability. We haven't focused primarily on special projects to look at these types of sites, maybe classified sites, repeatedly. So it's not like we've gotten involved in that area very much. I've primarily been oriented towards teaching beginners that they have this skill. And some of those people go on to the advanced classes and will do these sort of targets for fun. But no, I've never experienced any sort of contact with any government agency. Not that I'm aware of. Perhaps they keep track of people that do this. I wouldn't be surprised. But it's not something that I'm like formally aware of in any shape, any way that, We haven't been interfered with because at the end of the day, you don't have proof for a lot of these targets that it's what you saw is actually there. And you have to remember in the government program, SRI, I mean, if they viewed something like they viewed the Sugar Grove NSA facility in West Virginia, sort of by accident, the target was just someone's summer cabin, but just half a mile away or less was this huge NSA facility that was listening to Soviet satellites. When Pat Price and Ingo Swan viewed that, and there might've been other viewers, I'm just aware of Pat and Ingo. I mean, when they viewed that and viewed the code words inside the facility with 100% or near 100% accuracy, I mean, that definitely triggered a federal response. According to Russell Targan, people can see this in the movie Third Eye Spies, which goes into this in great detail. They got a response there, but then you're looking into a facility, you're saying, oh, here's what's inside, and here's the folders and the crypto keys and all sorts of sensitive information. You're going to get a response there. But we haven't done any sessions quite like that. And reading words and numbers, it's a rather challenging thing to do in our beginning. So, mm-hmm. And of course, Michael, even if you did nail it, you would never know, because we don't have that type of access. We're not SRI or anything. So we would never know, even if we got it we were in a facility and we accurately viewed it, how would you really know at the end of the day if it was correct or not?
Yeah. Well, I know I've heard of Pat Price, how he was so accurate, and what you just said, that he was able to look into files and read back the code words and the text and all of that. And apparently, soon after one of those incidents, he died of a heart attack, and some believe that he was assassinated because he was so good. What do you think of that?
I've heard all the different ideas, and I've talked to people at conferences, including people from the former Soviet Union, about what happened to Pat. And they go into this, by the way, in great detail in Third Eye Spies. Ultimately, I don't know. It's quite possible. People have told me they had him viewing Soviet targets daily. And that would be a pretty high motivation for the Soviet intelligence services at the time during the Cold War, right? To not want having, you know, have someone do that on such a frequent basis. So that's possible. He also did not eat a healthy diet. We're told that he lived on apple pie and cherry Coke. So that was the only thing he ever ate. So I could see him, and he did have a heart condition too. So ultimately, I don't know. The Soviets were engaged in assassination at the time of dissidents, right? I think it was Georgi Markov at the time, a Bulgarian, was assassinated that way in the UK with a shellfish toxin. And some people believe that's what happened to Pat. Someone said they saw someone, I think, when he was in a hotel somewhere, and they got very close to him. I don't know. It's just a mystery. And I think even in Third Eye Spies, they can't quite resolve it. It could have been natural causes. It could have been an assassination. I'm not sure.
Well, I want to get your take on this. The different protocols, methods that different remote viewing schools follow. I mean, there's the original remote viewers used the double blind protocol, and there's some more recent remote viewing schools that use the single blind remote viewing protocol. So what's the difference between those, and what's the advantages of doing double blind versus single blind?
Right. I think it's a good question. You know, when you start out, you want to use single blind targets because the monitor wants to see if the viewer is getting any target contact during the session. And, you know, just for the listeners, you know, double blind would be where the monitor doesn't know the target either. The monitor can still interview the viewer, even if they don't know what the target is, because the viewer can say, I see something red, it's square. But the monitor doesn't know what they're viewing, but you could just have them elaborate on what they're saying. So I think the single blind or even front loaded can be useful in initial stages. I think in early RV training, they used front loaded sessions more. They just wanted to see that the viewer could get anything. And front loaded would be, you would say the target is a structure, describe the structure. Target is a biological, describe the biological. So the viewer has sort of a little information, but not much detail. We've primarily only done it with single blind or double blind, occasionally front loaded, just to show people the difference. Double blind has more scientific value just because it's cleaner from a methodological point, right? Because you can always argue, and I was even using, ChatGPT this morning to see what it says about RV. And I completely disagree with what ChatGPT says about RV. It says there's no scientific evidence to support it, which I think flies in the face of 100 years of research. Of course, AI is just averaging and summing what other people have said. It doesn't have its own mind. So it's just repeating what it sees in Wikipedia and other sources. And I think in this case, it's just inaccurate. I mean, I wouldn't want ChatGPT flying my plane because it got RV. Like, it's just saying what you're going to kind of get from a typical academic point of view 20 years ago. But when you do want to do it in a way that has scientific value, so there's no, it did mention in ChatGPT, like there could be information leakage. So that would be, Michael, perhaps I'm the viewer, you're the monitor. And you could argue maybe there's subliminal signals that you're sending me about the target that I'm interpreting in some way, you know, body motion, language, micro movements, and so forth, that you're secretly communicating information about the target to me. without words. So when we're doing it double blind, then if the monitor doesn't know, or triple blind, like literally no one knows, or the target hasn't even been chosen yet, maybe we haven't even chosen it yet, and we're going to use a random number generator to select the target afterwards, you could discount signal linkage, right? Because the monitor, even though you're interviewing me and saying, Simeon, tell me more about X, Y, or whatever I'm saying, if you don't know it, we can say, well, that's more controlled. So I think the double blind has more control to it, and it's certainly what you want to use if you were doing some sort of scientific study and you want to show some sort of statistics about the sessions and so forth. But it's not necessarily the best for teaching people at the beginning.
Okay. So why don't you tell us about how your interest in crop circles began? And I know you sent me an image of a triple Julia. So yeah, why don't you tell us about that whole kind of remote viewing of a crop circle?
Before we do that, I want to just mention one double blind session. I did send you one. It's called RV Computer.
Oh yeah, please.
That session is double blind. And that was from this woman, Lorraine, who had been in the Olympics 5 times as a marathon runner. She liked the RV protocol because it was very similar to how her coach taught her to run long distances and excel and win races. And as you can see, the target was this picture. That's what laptops looked like in the 90s, by the way. This was an ad for a Toshiba laptop in the 90s, 97 to be exact. And this is a person juggling, right? This guy juggling, and look at what she's able to reproduce. Now, this is double blind. I had about 20, 30 targets under the table. I pulled one out, put it in the folder under a very thick oak table. There's no way I can see what the picture is. I pull the folder up. This is a target. I have no idea. It could be any of those pictures. And she's able to reproduce that in a picture perfect way, right? You can see it. So that's an example of how accurate double blind can be. I have no clue what the target is, and she's still able to, in her P3 drawing, it's one of the phases in the CRV system. Oh, since I didn't completely answer your question, by the way. The CRV system is a written system. That's what Ingo Swann developed. Since that was his job at SRI, was to develop a system that the average person could, non-natural psychics could do. And he felt like he had decoded in his mind what he was doing as a natural psychic that the average person could learn to do it. And that's what we do. The other systems have different names, and they're more, they're maybe more stream of thought, less protocol to them. So there's always this debate, which is better. And I don't think any of them are better than any others. It's just which works best for you. I learned the CRV system, so that's what I teach. So this is the example of double blind phase 3 drawing, which is, I mean, I think if I gave you a stack of 100 targets, Michael, you could probably pick out the first time which one this was. So in any case, so on to the crop
circles. Did you roll on the wall?
This is how I got introduced to crop circles. It was a target at Farsight in one of the, I believe, might have been one of the second level courses. There were a number of levels there. I think this might have been in that class. I didn't at the time ever, I'd never heard of a crop circle, and I hadn't seen this picture ahead of time. It's in a folder behind your back. In a fairly large room, maybe 20 feet away from you is the target picture. And we actually used these gray cubicles, just like the military had done. It was very, the protocol was very accurate there. And so when I saw the feedback, I really got curious into what I had been viewing. I mean, there is the session there of what my target looks like. It's a picture of these lines coming up and down. Triple RV, that picture shows what I was able to draw. It looks like a circle with lines of energy coming in and out, doesn't it? That was my interpretation of this P3 while I'm doing it. Before, Michael, I had ever heard of the word crop circle. This is not in my vocabulary. No one in graduate school talks about crop circles at that time. They should, but they didn't. And I got curious. What, if I'm drawing this, there's beings down there or people or whatever in a circle, and this sort of hills behind there and energy lines. That's what they felt like to me, going in and out. I don't know what this is, but when I got the target, I'm told, hey, this is a crop circle, and this appeared in 96 earlier. This is the triple Julia, I believe, of 96. So June or July. So I just got curious, and later that year I went to a UFO conference, first time ever. I thought, hey, I should go to a conference and learn more about these subjects. And I ran into a guy named Ron Russell, who you might have heard lecture from time to time at different conferences, and he was giving these tours. So I went on his tour. I wanted to get my feedback, right? Does any good viewer want, what are these things? These are huge. They're made in grain crop. They appear in grain crop or made in grain crops. And that is how I ended up studying and being involved in crop circles. When I went over there with Ron, we had instances of extreme camera failure from very reliable name brand cameras and VC, you know, video cameras that never failed. All of a sudden you'd go in the crop circle, they would overheat, they would melt inside. You heard stories from people. My sociology mind initially thought, are these stories around crop circles urban legend, folklore, or are they real? But I could see from talking to people and from our experiences in the group, even that summer, 97, that there were anomalous EM fields around these patterns. And I've been studying them ever since.
It's very interesting because I know that people have reported equipment failure, especially for electronics, around UFO craft. Contactees have described cameras don't work. So, you know, that would suggest some phenomena that are involving high voltage electrostatics, torsion fields, however these craft are powered or propelled, that somehow that interferes with human technology.
Right. And that was the idea that we had at the time. And it wasn't until 2000 that we started running into these people that told us they could make these at night. And we initially didn't believe them because they're so big. That triple Julia is like, you know, like 200 feet across. It's large. Very, you know, precisely put down there. But we did start going out with these groups. And I mean, this is what I wrote about in Opening Minds, that we found they could make them. It wasn't like they were hoaxers, like we had been told. Like maybe these are mostly made by ET with a few hoaxers. These were people that believed in something energetically significant happening in the pattern once it was there. And so what we found is that even the man-made circles were also causing some of the electronic camera battery failure. Now, it's not like these were man-made from the beginning, because there were witnesses to like the Tully saucer nest in Australia. I think it was Doug Bauer from the Doug and Dave team who got inspired by seeing these, you know, swirled patterns of crops where discs had been in Tully, Australia. And I've talked to witnesses who've seen meadows flattened by discs. It's in Black Swan Ghost. I had a witness from us, Washington, picking huckleberries, who saw that this wobbly disc, that's early 70s. She told me the word UFO wasn't even in the vocabulary she saw, but she saw this flying disc, and as it left, it went right over the meadow, and she said it just flattened as it left. I mean, flat as a pancake. Those were literally her words. So to me, that sounds a lot like crop circles. But groups of people did start imitating this in the late 80s and 90s, and the big surprise to us was that even the man-made ones had these weird effects on our static meter, on cameras and batteries, which suggests that the shape itself or some sort of interaction with plants is creating these non-ordinary EM fields. You're showing the static meter we used, this Trek 520 meter from a company in Medina, New York, and we would find extreme static changes in some of the crop circles, and that could have something to do with their this energetic activity around crop circles. So I think, Michael, the topic has been oversimplified. People have thought it's either got to be all ET or all man-made. You know, it's somewhere in the middle. And even the human-made ones, seemingly, if they're done in the right precision or right intention, there's one of our group members, when we paid a farmer at Hill Martin in 2001 to make a very large one, we took some boards and ropes, and we would tell people this is a public project. We're not trying to fool anyone. We just want to see if we can do anything that looks like the ones we've been studying. And we were surprised to see that these would affect our electrostatic meter and occasionally create battery failure and so forth. And we've seen this many times. Yeah, so this one, we had permission coming back from Austin, Texas, the 2002 IRVA conference, the first time that Ingo Swann spoke in at the IRVA conference. We made a very small one outside of Hayes, Kansas. And all of the photos came out like this, Michael. We made this in half an hour, 20 minutes. It's small with the boards and the ropes. And it affected this Nikon, I believe, F3 camera. Ron's camera, professional SLR film camera. All of the photos came out like looking like what I'm showing you right here. And that is proof that there's something going on. The camera never did that before, and it never did it again. Something about that formation was creating effects that I don't even know what we're looking at there. That's another one. And I put that one in opening minds. A Japanese tourist was able to photograph that. I believe she saw this with her eye. Now, this is an example how the spiral shape of the grain is affecting the pollen. It's actually creating a spiral DNA type pattern in the pollen there in the center of the circle. This is very reminiscent of a Russian researcher named Grabinikov, who argued that he called it the cavernous structure effect, and wheat stalks being hollow could perhaps create this sort of effect on water and affect matter around it. So it's an interesting way. This goes back to the idea of cymatics, how shapes could affect frequency and so forth.
So that is very interesting. So very large geometrical patterns in nature actually can generate an energy field, you know, regardless of who made it. So whether it's UFO extraterrestrials or whether it's people using planks and boards, that in the end you make there's some kind of geometrical shape, you know, in a field. There's going to be a distinct frequency that's created that could interfere with a measuring equipment.
Right. This is the big take-home message from our time in the crop circles, is that it's not just a product of orbs and UFOs and perhaps wind vortices and plasmas. There could be a variety of causes of crop circles, but the pattern itself affects the energy flow. My feeling all along was that it was affecting flows of dark matter. It was affecting something very strongly in the area that our devices were picking up. And the only thing that I could think of at the time, and I still think it's true, it's affecting the flow of relic neutrinos and dark matter. And we can talk about this another time. It has to do with cold fusion Leonard. Is that there's other types of matter we can't see that science tells us are there. And they are, some of them at least, relic neutrinos, a tiny percentage of dark matter, 1% or something around, that fluxes and flows around shapes. This could be why there are vortex areas and certain cathedrals and places like this create a feeling that you could feel, because they're affecting the flow of these relic neutrinos, what you might call ether or something like that. If you go back to that previous slide, by the way, the Danbury Triad, this was the one that melted the solder joints on a Sony camcorder in 97. Ron had been shooting video of us in the circle. He left it on, but it wasn't taking film. It wasn't shooting film at the time. Put it down right in the center of that circle. And we picked it up about 5 minutes later, and it was hot, really hot, and it wasn't working. He sent it back to Sony, and they said that the power transformer had discharged all at once, the battery, and melted the wires. It had to be resoldered. So again, this is an example of how a shape could create non-ordinary electromagnetic fields, like it's concentrating energy in some way or focusing it like a lens. So again, this is something we've seen many times, and it seems like these very precise shapes are the ones that have the electronic effects. I'll tell you, Michael, the square types of patterns and more stylized patterns that were done for adverts, advertisements, and you know, projects like that never had the effect that these circular spiral patterns had. The next one you were showing, so-called Devil's Den pattern that you were showing there next to that dolmen, you had it up a second ago. That effect, yes, this one affected three devices in half an hour. My static meter went offline walking in at the edge, just right at the edge. Boom, it just freezes up. Batteries are gone. Masamaki, a sushi restaurant owner here in Boulder, who I never knew here, but I met him over in the UK. His brand new camcorder stopped working about 10, 20 feet from the edge of that circle. And then some folks came in, Rob Spate, who we were just sitting there, and they said, "What's happening to our GPS?" It had 14 hours of battery life. By the way, the videos of this are on my YouTube channel under Weird Effects Around Crop Circles. I have a playlist of some of these weird things happening. If my camera was still working, I could film it. So their GPS with brand new batteries instantly discharged as they walked into that so-called Devil's Den formation at five field down. So this was an example in 99 of a crop formation that affected three devices in the span of half an hour that I could see. Talking to other people who have visited, they said, "Yes, that happened to my camera too." I said, "Well, how long did it not work?" They said it took like 6 months in a drawer, and I pulled it out one day and it was working again. So some real, you know, non-ordinary field is created by the shape of these crop circles, where ordinary devices with a sort of fixed permittivity and permeability, which is normally set at 1 by physics. Speed of light's based on permittivity and permeability, if you know anything about the history of electromagnetism. And it could be affected in some way that the whole structure of space-time is changed enough to make electronics no longer function properly. In other words, I'm suggesting, Michael, that insulators are becoming conductors, and this is why things are shorting out. And that can only happen because what Hal Puthoff calls space-time metric engineering. The crop circles could be an example of space-time metric engineering. By the way, I was so curious about this Devil's Den formation. The story, how we found it was in a very remote part of Wiltshire. We had to walk all day to find it. We were told it's somewhere out there. We got our maps out and we walked for hours. Towards the end of the day, we said, "Oh, there it is, way down there in that valley." And we came back later that evening, and that's when all this weird stuff happened. I went back a few months later in October of 99 to see what it would be like when it had been harvested, because a researcher in UK, Busty Taylor, said maybe it's underground springs. It has nothing to do with the crops there. Good point. So I went back in October of 99. It had been harvested. There was no electronic effects, no effect on the static meter whatsoever. So it had something to do with those crops, wheat crop being there in a pattern at that time that affected.
Do you roll on the line?
I wanted to get your reaction to the very famous video of several orbs creating a crop circle at Oliver's Castle. So I'll play the video of that. And I just wanted to get you to kind of like comment. What do you think is happening here with this, what appears to be several orbs creating a crop circle in 1989 near Oliver's Castle, Wiltshire?
So I have seen orbs in the UK, and I sent you some pictures of some of them. You'll see them. Woodborough is an example where someone saw that looking in our direction. And I've seen them on the ground. I filmed one below a cloud. So I have seen these orbs or ball lightning, whatever they may be, for myself. However, this video, from my information, was done in an animation studio by a guy named John Wabe. He admitted to it when someone asked him about it. So my view of this formation, even though it's very beautiful to watch, and it may be representative of how some of them are formed, the video itself, from my research, is that it was done by someone. The videographer worked at an animation studio. So my view of it is that it's very good CGI. And that's not to totally take away the value. Even people seeing something like that could open your mind to be interested in orbs and ball lightning and coherent matter. So, but the video itself, I think, is actually animation. I'm sorry to disappoint people if anyone thought that was proof of orbs making them. Perhaps they do. They have been seen around crop circles, and there's a picture one Woodboro of one hovering over a crop circle in that field, in the East Field. But that particular video, from my information of people who talked to John Wabe, who was an animator, and he filmed it stuff, and he told people ahead of time where he was going. It does seem to have been a, you know, the best that CGI could do at the time in whenever that was, around late 90s or something.
Okay, well, that's okay. Very interesting. I mean, I have heard others say that the video is genuine because whether it was the videographer, I think the camera, whoever took the video claims to have gone to a nearby pub and told them of a crop circle. He saw a crop circle created at that location, and then people went the next morning, and there was this big, exactly that crop circle. I guess so.
That's my view of that. Yeah.
Well, I don't want to keep you much longer. I know you have another interview soon. So, what are you working on now, and what do you think is going to be happening over the next 12 months?
Well, look, this is very interesting times. These topics are being talked about in Congress, Mike. And I mean, I had a brief conversation with Jay Stratton over at Phenomicon in Vernal last fall, and he was in charge of, he's mentioned in the Lukatsky book as Axelrod, not the Axelrod from Penetration, but James Lukatsky. Yes. So he told me these hearings have been going on since 2017 in front of Congress, ever since the New York Times article that really broke this story open. I mean, I have to tell you, I had an article set up for the New York Times around 2013 about these subjects through someone I knew that had contacts at the New York Times. And they were going to run a story in the business section about my crop circle tours and so forth. And this person who wrote it was very interested. And the night before it was going to run, the editor said, "I don't like it. I'm not running." So how much times have changed from the early 2010s, 2011, 2012, around when it was, to 2017, where they have this front page story about UFOs and secret government programs. And it's high time that our society have a discussion about what exactly people are seeing. I've met a lot of witnesses over the years, and that's really the basis for, I'm revising this right now for a second edition, since I'm always talking to new witnesses. And we have to have a discussion about what pilots and people who serve in the military and people who are just out at night are seeing, plus closer contact, people with missing time, people who have encountered these beings wherever they're from, and things that we don't even have names for. I mean, types of technology, types of living creatures or beings. I mean, what are people encountering? It's been, you know, your channel is devoted to this, and you've been talking about this for several decades now. I mean, what are we dealing with here? And I think Congress is finally hearing this. They're not sharing a lot of what they're hearing. I'm told it's classified hearings mostly. But we know people are going to DC, people you and I know who've spoken at these conferences, people who've worked in the Air Force and other places and are telling our Congress people, our representatives, what they know. And it appears that there are extensive black budget programs within the U.S. government that have been operating since the time of Roswell, or maybe even before, to see if this has a technological advantage. And unfortunately, the downside is, because they're interested in the technology of it, they haven't shared very much with the U.S. public. In fact, they've had disinformation programs going on since the 50s, as far as I can tell. Just the opposite. They've been studying it in secret, in classified programs. And they've been publicly telling everyone, oh, these are just, you know, this is swamp gas and misidentifications of Venus and ball lightning and so forth. And it's been, it's been fabricated that people have been seeing something. And this phenomena is important. It's something that we all should know about. It's how nature works. It's other types of natural technology. Perhaps these propulsion systems based on manipulating space-time. It's how physics already works. Michael Einstein talked about a variable speed of light in 1907. It's a long time ago. Over 100 years ago, Einstein was broaching the idea of a variable speed of light. And it wasn't, he had just done enough to, establish his theories of relativity. I don't think he wanted to go in another direction at the time. He didn't feel it was necessary. But we've had these ideas there to talk about for decades. And I think we're moving in that direction. It does seem that we're getting people, David Grush and others, coming forward saying, look, this is real. I know about this. There's crash retrievals. There are bodies of the occupants of these craft. I've personally spoken to people who've been asked to see if they can figure out how these materials work, these space-time metric materials. So I think there's a big story coming here. If the witnesses I've been talking to over the decades are telling me about what they've experienced, I think there's a lot of people we haven't heard from yet who know exactly what's, to some degree, what's going on. And so I'm involved in, studying these topics. I continue to teach RV classes. And perhaps in the next time we talk together, we'll talk about the link between the crop circles and Bigfoot and cryptids, which I was startled to find that there are these similar types of experiences people have around these phenomena.
So, well, I definitely look forward to talking to you again about your books and that topic, that connection between cryptids and crop circles. That is fascinating. So we will talk about that. So where do people go, Simeon, if they want to learn about your upcoming classes, buy a book?
Yeah, you can go to my blog, newcrystalmind.com. New Crystal Mind, it's a link to my website, the virtual viewing site, which allows people to have different ways to get viewing instruction, either live or recorded classes. There's links there to get signed copies of my books at newcrystalmind.com, and pretty much find out anything I'm involved with at the moment. So I have a YouTube channel, extensive YouTube channel. It's been going since 2009. It's a long, when I started with YouTube, Michael, you were limited to 15 minutes. And if you had good behavior, YouTube extended the length of your videos. I think it started out at 10 minutes, if I'm not mistaken. If you were good, they left you 15 minutes. So those early videos were like pretty short. So I have a YouTube channel and I'm on Twitter, and feel free to contact me and interact in any way that you find interesting.
So newcrystalmind.com, simeonpine.com, a couple of your websites. So we will put those in the description for this interview. So thank you, Simeon, for informing us about your fascinating background and history and remote viewing. And I'm looking forward to the next interview.
Thanks a lot, Michael. We'll talk to you next time.
You have been listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.